Thanks for listening to Pod of Jake. I'm Jake. You can reach me anytime by emailing jake@blogofjake.com. I'm fortunate to have some sponsors supporting the show whose products I genuinely love and recommend. I'll start with a word on those so the rest of the episode will have no interruptions. I hope you enjoy. This episode is brought to you by Levels. Levels uses continuous glucose monitoring to track your blood sugar in real time. It allows me to see the impact that everything I do has on my metabolic health so that I can optimize my diet and exercise accordingly. Wearing the Levels patch, I feel like I'm living in the future. There's this moment when you raise your phone to the back of your arm, it vibrates and shows your glucose level right on the screen. It's this instantaneous look inside yourself, an in-the-moment snapshot of what's going on inside your body. And while it's only showing one simple measurement for now, it's enough for me to see the future. And that's exciting. It's exciting because I believe that we can live meaningfully longer and healthier lives than we do today, and I believe technologies like Levels will help us to get there. Levels is currently running an exclusive beta program with a waitlist of over 100,000 people, but you can skip the line and join Levels today by using my link in the show notes, levels.link/Jake. Again, that's levels.link/Jake. This episode is brought to you by Aura. That's Oura. The Oura Ring, from my perspective, is the single best wearable on the market. I use it to measure my sleep, activity, and readiness on a daily basis. I bought my Oura Ring several months ago before talking with the company's CEO on the podcast. I haven't taken it off since. I believe what gets measured gets managed. So if you care at all about your health, which you should, you have to measure your sleep in order to manage it. Oura measures much more than just my time in bed. It tracks my REM sleep versus deep sleep, my resting heart rate and heart rate variability, my temperature, my activity, and much, much more. For $299, you can get your own Oura Ring on auraring.com. That's auraring.com. Auraring.com. Okay, let's get into it. Thank you, Mike, for joining me on the podcast today and coming on the show. It's great to have you. You are the you're a founder and general partner at Six Man Ventures. You also recently co-founded a really interesting crypto project, Lynx DAO, which is sort of like Web3 meets golf, two passions of mine personally and probably a lot of people listening. So excited for the discussion ahead. You've also got a great past across a bunch of different companies from Disney to Venmo and things like that. So I think the best place to start would just be for you to sort of tell your story from as early as you're willing to start to some of the things you're doing today and the decisions you made along the way.
Awesome. Yeah. Thanks for having me, Jake. Really excited to be here. And excited about those two projects that you mentioned. And we'll definitely, we'll go way back and start young and sort of get to why I'm working on what I am these days. So you grew up in Connecticut and went to college at Stanford. So basically you did before I was 20, got like your full on East Coast, like prep school Northeast. And then, basically through the dot-com bust, was in college sort of observing firsthand in Silicon Valley, what was happening in the tech world, two very different experiences that were formative for me, and exciting. So I've always been a coastal person. My first job out of college was at Disney, really exciting. So instead of doing banking or consulting, I basically combined the two into one job and worked in Disney's corporate strategic planning group. So working on businesses that like I was passionate about. And so I got to work with ESPN, with ABC. So all the cable networks and television properties that Disney owned on strategic issues. Got an MBA, had a lot of fun. Wouldn't say I learned a lot during those couple of years at Kellogg in Chicago, and then moved back to the East Coast. And I've been in New York the last 15 years, 16, 17 years now. Getting kind of old. So I'm 42, which makes me a boomer in my current industry of crypto. But since I moved back to the East Coast and moved to New York, live in Manhattan, I've worked in tech the entirety of the time. So started at a startup 2007 to 2009, and then spent 4 years at Google. Started at YouTube and then moved into fintech. So sort of the first decade of my career ending with Google was in media and entertainment. Learned a lot there. About basically how technology was impacting the media and entertainment industries, and then switched completely to fintech and learned about how technology was impacting the financial industry, payments, and commerce writ large. So spent 4 years at Google Wallet, moved to Braintree and Venmo. They were part of the same company, Braintree, at the time. Watched Venmo explode in growth in the year and a half I was there. And we were bought by PayPal. In 2014, I left PayPal and started my first company. I think I was 34 years old. And it was a mobile commerce company, and it combined, you know, media. So it was a mobile affiliate company where we worked with publishers, helped them monetize their mobile sites, and helped them connect to commerce companies. So it was affiliate, pure affiliate model. So it kind of blended fintech with media. Had a lot of fun doing that and being a founder. I was the head of revenue, so chief revenue officer. But, you know, basically, so I discovered Bitcoin in 2013 when I was at Braintree Venmo, and you know, never felt perfect in the 4 years that I was working on, you know, what we would now call a Web 2 startup. And you know, had this constant pull once I understood what Bitcoin was, you know, permissionless, global, at the time, theoretically low fee, censorship resistant, always on payments or money movement network. And so in 2018, had watched the industry or the sort of crypto ecosystem grow, and Ethereum had launched, and there'd been a bunch of ICOs, and there were a number of other blockchains, and decided, hey, I can't miss this. This is like the future of money, markets, and commerce, and frankly, of the internet. And so I jumped in 2018 full-time to crypto. So I am always interested in, you know, technologies that are sort of on the edge. And I'm also interested in consumer and business usage. So how do we get people using the technology? Not like the really, really deep, deep, deep protocol layer, but the actual application business and consumer application layer. But when I jumped into crypto, it's so overwhelming and gnarly, and it takes an entire team to frankly understand what's going on any given app or protocol. So I started a business called The Block, which was it exists and it's really large. It's one of the leading crypto info services businesses, media, research, and data. And you know, we wanted to do crypto simplified and be retail facing and give folks information about the tokens and things they were purchasing and how they were used. The challenge is we went into a bear market immediately. So we became institutional, and we served the institutional customer base who stuck around through the bear market from 2018 to, you know, late 2020, early 2021. I sold that company, The Block, last year, and joined a company called Paxos, which is primarily a crypto as a service. So they provide crypto brokerage services to PayPal, Venmo, and many other really large companies. They also have a stablecoin business. So the third largest stablecoin issuer in the world. Stablecoins are really, really interesting to me. So a traditional or typical cryptocurrency like Bitcoin or Ethereum has a tremendous amount of volatility. A stablecoin is pegged to the dollar or some other underlying fiat asset or commodity like gold. And so stablecoins are interesting in that you can actually use them for commerce. They run on these same global, open, permissionless networks, but are pegged, again, to the dollar, so are more stable. Spent a year doing that. And last year, while I was doing that, started a venture firm called Six Man Ventures with one of my best friends from Stanford. We had met in the Sixth Man student basketball club in college. And so, you know, we named the firm after, you know, sort of our Genesis meeting. But it's apropos to sort of how crypto venture capital works. Your job is to basically help the protocols, projects, founders as needed, but not to be kind of overbearing in the manner of, you know, how many traditional VCs have operated. Yeah, I've seen it firsthand, and I know many other entrepreneurs who have had overbearing VCs. Crypto VC is typically much more collaborative. The VCs are typically entrepreneurs themselves, users of the protocols, and really, you know, get their hands dirty with the founders. So have had a tremendous amount of fun. The other thing about crypto venture capital versus traditional VCs, many firms, including ours, are more indexed, so have more investment positions with a smaller ownership percentage than traditional VC. And so our specialty is go-to-market. So it's PR, communications, marketing, business development. And so it's been a lot of fun. And we just raised our second fund, $145 million. And we added two partners, And one of the partners we added, a guy named Carl Vogel, worked with me at Paxos. He's an engineer. And we're building out a research practice, a practical research for founders. So we have a full service, early stage Web3 venture capital firm in crypto. We invest in equity and tokens. We could talk more about that, but it's a tremendous amount of fun. In addition, I'm still an entrepreneur, started a project, as you mentioned, called LinksDAO. And what LinksDAO is it's a community-driven golf and leisure club. So anyone, anywhere in the world can purchase an NFT. That NFT gives them the right to vote and make decisions on what the LinksDAO golf club will look like. Hey, where the club will be located, the first club, and there's going to be more than one, what the rules will be, the membership rules, the style, and many other things about how the community and the club are run. In addition, the NFT gives you the right to purchase a membership. So it's pretty exciting, novel model that's very inclusive. We have 15,000 people in our Discord. We have 5,500 people who own the NFTs and are members and voting on what the club should look like. And the first physical golf club will be launching next year. There will also be digital golf courses. So it's both an in real life and online experience that ties a group of folks with a common interest together and that anybody can access. So it's super, super exciting. And again, it gets to this idea of practical usage of technology. So a third of the folks who have joined LinksDAO are first time NFT owners. And that's really, really exciting to me. We also love to invest in apps that attract people to crypto for the first time. And so an example of that is an app called Stepn, Stepn. We invested in their seed round. It's one of the fastest growing Web3 apps of all time. And it's a move to earn concept. So in other words, you earn money for walking and running. So it's basically you buy an NFT that has certain powers attached to it and energy attached to it, and you actually earn as you move. So as you walk or run a certain amount, on a daily basis, and then needs to recharge. So it's really exciting. It has a great mission of getting people out, moving, and earning. So that's kind of a quick intro to me, my interests, my background, and excited to kind of chat more about what's interesting to you out of that.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, we're obviously going to talk about LinksDAO a bit, and I want to go back and get the origin story of your golf career. I know maybe career is a strong word, but curious to know where you started there and how you got into golf. Were you going out with Tiger during your time at Stanford, or how'd
Boy,
that go?
I wish. So I got to Stanford right after Tiger had left. And it's funny, my freshman year roommate was on the golf team, and he had received Tiger scholarship. But he wasn't Tiger. So anyway, but it was really cool. I played a lot in college, not on the college team, of course. But growing up, I played golf in high school, and I grew up in like the Connecticut country club environment. So sort of exclusive, expensive, closed. The rules were intense on kind of like no wearing hats, like women not allowed on the men's porch, things like that. And that, experience, it really did genuinely make me uncomfortable. I never sort of felt like an insider. I always felt like an outsider, especially as a kid, as a part of a family membership. So that was definitely a part of, the inspiration for me in terms of starting LinksDAO. In my adulthood, I've primarily just played public courses, haven't had, really haven't joined a club. And so, it's been really difficult to do that, living in Manhattan. So you're really excited to get back into it and just to meet so many people who have wanted the opportunity to play golf, to be part of a community, aren't part of a country club. But have met, for example, folks in their area, whether it be Southern California, whether it be Florida, Georgia, you name it, via LinksDAO.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned sort of the nature of golf and the way that the culture is, and I think it remains in large part that way today. But what's really cool about what you guys are doing, it's open to everyone, and obviously you guys don't have a course yet, but ambition to buy sort of a world-class course and open it up to all the members. That's an interesting component. Also, what you mentioned, a third of the NFT holders being sort of first-time NFT holders, pretty new to crypto. Definitely on theme with what you said earlier about being passionate about sort of onboarding new people. Has that been challenging to sort of educate these new people? Like, hold on, You bought your NFT. That doesn't mean like you own a slice of the golf course yet. We've got this long roadmap, sort of gradual decentralization. Have you had to spend a lot of sort of resources educating these sort of first-time crypto people who just happen to be passionate about golf and interested in crypto?
Oh, absolutely. So spent an incredible amount of time on that. We basically, we've done a number of Discord podiums, Twitter spaces, one-on-one help. And we're not the only ones. I've talked to a number of other folks who have started DAOs or have started Web3 projects, and the amount of time that it takes, the UI UX of crypto is not easy. And you wouldn't expect it to be, given the things that we're doing require self-custody of assets, which is a really complex concept for people. You're used to just having a bank account online with a password and trusted parties. It's different. It's sort of the Wild West. You see it all the time with the common meme is people getting their Bored Ape Yacht Club stolen through clicking a bad link or something like that. So we have to work really, really hard to educate people about how to be super, super secure with their assets and not click links that they're not familiar with, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, it makes sense. And I understand you guys were pretty quick to go from like idea to reality with this whole thing. I think I read somewhere 18 days from sort of having the idea to launching and selling the first NFTs. I think you guys raised on the order of like 10 or $11 million in like a day or something like that. I got almost 10,000 memberships. What was the experience like sort of going from idea you just knew right away, like this was the thing you wanted to chase?
We had a tremendous amount of momentum. It was like within a couple of days of announcing the project, we had, I don't know, 10,000 plus Twitter followers, 5,000 plus people in Discord, and just a tremendous amount of momentum online and in the different sort of crypto communities that started to spill over, where you'd hear people saying, "Hey, like I'm telling my dad or my brother or my sister about this," so or my friends. And so we knew we had sort of lightning in a bottle, and that, as you know, like crypto, it's such a momentum game that we felt it was imperative that we took advantage of the attention that we had, the credibility we had. We were maybe a month after Constitution DAO, which was an inspiration for what we did, where they, a bunch of folks raised money to try to buy a copy of the Constitution. They ended up not succeeding, but they raised a bunch of money and gave a roadmap for galvanizing fundraising towards a common goal. And so, with the markets being so unpredictable in crypto, we said, "Hey, we've got a moment in time. Let's do it." I'm glad we did the sale, and we did. The price of Ethereum was $3,800 at that time, and I think today it's $2,700. So we converted the proceeds into stablecoin, and we have a healthy treasury to accomplish our objectives. But yeah, it was just really important to maintain the momentum that we had with the idea. We also were reinforced by how many people jumped in and actually started contributing actively. So on like the third day, I think I posted like a document, "Hey, like what should this club be?" And honestly, I think we had hundred, no joke, hundreds of people who were in the doc. We had a handful of folks who were like really organizing it and organizing the thoughts. Nobody jumped in and wrote like spammy stuff that would make me have to, take the doc down. It was really remarkable to watch. And so we've done our best to continue to push forward with that kind of ethos and mindset since.
Yeah, I mean the whole DAO, you've seen these things pop up all over the place over the last year or so, and I think an ambitious name in and of itself, like DAO, decentralized autonomous organization, where that's sort of nice in theory, but in practice, it's got to be really challenging, right? To there's a reason that all these successful companies the last 20 years and every history before that have been so successful sort of makes sense to have like one leader and an executive team and just sort of organized more hierarchically. What have been the challenges of like you get hundreds of people in a Google Doc and you're sort of at the head of this thing or co-founder with a couple of other leaders, but trying to organize like all this excitement and momentum into actually like executing and getting things done. Have you guys like navigated sort of the balance of, I think you've mentioned sort of gradual decentralization, but starting with sort of more of a, okay, we've got a few people are sort of making key decisions and driving things with hundreds of people supporting. And then eventually we're going to try to make it where it's like much more community owned and everything like that.
Yeah, so what I'll say to start, and you made a good observation, right? The dictionary definition of a DAO is decentralized autonomous organization. There are very few of those in the world, and in the world of crypto. Autonomous is a really challenging one in particular, right? It means, hey, people vote based on, some criteria, a number of tokens that they hold or something else. And if a specific threshold is hit, like a smart contract makes something else happen, right? Ours is not that. It's I would call it like an air quotes DAO is what I say. It has a level of decentralization and that everybody can participate in the vote. It's not autonomous. I'm sorry, anybody who has an NFT can participate in the vote. It's not autonomous in the sense that it's not. So what's voted on is, in our case today, a recommendation or sort of an advisory board decision. And there is a group of community leaders and a group of folks at the corporate level who kind of help craft the proposals and then implement the proposals once they're voted on and approved, if they're approved. The reality is, to achieve what we're trying to achieve in the real world, where there's like a physical aspect to it, which is purchase and operate a golf course. I don't believe that there, and the folks who are participating don't believe there's a scenario in which you could have the 5,500 NFT members just collectively trying to operate this thing with no leadership. There are, some things where, you could actually have a true DAO today, like making, perhaps just straight investment decisions. I think that's where you're seeing some of the most common ones. And then in DeFi, decentralized finance, there are some DAOs where basically the on-chain vote specifically dictates what happens. But anyway, in our case, that's not true. We're a DAO in spirit, I would say. I kind of just think of us as more of like a Web3 network that, is where we have a token, in our case, an NFT that conveys governance rights and helps people to coordinate, vote and make decisions on the future of a project that they're taking part of.
Right. And yeah, I mean, I think DAO is sort of like a broad label where there's this big spectrum. Like you mentioned, some of the DeFi DAOs are more, in turn, like they're more autonomous, they're more decentralized, and then there's others that, stamp the label of DAO on them, but it's not really that. And you guys are somewhere in between on that spectrum and likely to probably progress to the more decentralized, more autonomous
Yeah.
side of things over time.
The example of what we would try to do over time is what I think will happen is more of you can kind of use what's happening with Yuga Labs and Ape DAO or Ape Coin DAO as a analogy where over time you basically have two separate entities. You have the corporation like Yuga Labs in their case that basically sells the assets and builds certain things. And then you have the DAO that's separate that again is governed by a token and basically that token can be used to bring in sort of third parties and everybody's a participant, by the way, including the people from Yuga Labs, right? But it allows broader community participation. And these things have to work in concert, right? Like Ape DAO doesn't really work without Yuga Labs having the ability to execute. And but the key is just like with the DAOs and selling NFTs, you can't sell things that in the United States for sure, you can't sell an NFT in sort of a KYC, non-KYC way that conveys like ownership in an asset that's viewed as a unregistered security offering. So so people basically have structures that allow them to execute on things and things that may have ownership or may have operational objectives. But again, that's often separate from what the DAO is doing itself.
Right. And so you mentioned Constitution DAOs being one of the DAOs that was sort of inspiring to you guys, what they did on a fundraising angle. I haven't really seen it with another project to that degree. It was really impressive. Are there others that are, either were or continue to be inspirations in terms of other aspects of what you guys are trying to do, whether it's membership or the sort of IRL component that's much less common amongst DAOs?
Yeah, so the Fly Fish Club, Gary Vaynerchuk's token gated restaurant was an inspiration. Just seeing how you buy the NFT and the NFT conveys you like membership at their restaurant, similar to what it, being a member of Rao's, the legendary New York restaurant, where you kind of had to know, like, be part of the club to get in. With Fly Fish Club, if you own the NFT, you can make a reservation, and if you don't, you can't. Those NFTs are transferable, by the way, which is you can sell it to somebody else, and it's just a very interesting model that inspired us.
Right. So, going back to your story a little bit, you jumped sort of all over the place early on in your career and eventually started your first company in your early 30s, I think you said. Was that something where, obviously, like you picked up some experience at Disney, sounded like, you did an MBA, but might not necessarily recommend it to someone today. Did you have this bug of, wanting to start your own thing for a long time, or it just sort of came together?
Yeah, so I would to for me, the MBA story is just very specific to me. Like, I had learned things prior to getting my MBA that probably made it unnecessary, and I think it was more of a delaying tactic of not knowing what I wanted to do. I wouldn't say that I wish I'd had conviction in knowing exactly what I wanted to do before I was 34, but I didn't. It took me a long time to kind of figure it out and find stability. And I'll be candid, like, entrepreneurship, like, I grew up sort of, my dad was an entrepreneur, we had a family business, but I didn't innately know how to, like, start a business while I was growing up. In college, I was like I was always very good at, like, studying, and I knew how to do that. I knew how to work in a corporate job, Disney and Google and others. But yeah, I didn't really feel like I knew how to just, like, create a new idea. I'm not an engineer either, right? So it took time to really learn how to take something from the idea stage, like, work with or put together a team, raise, financing if necessary, and then, like, get out there and, like, build it from zero to one. Now that I know how to do it, in retrospect, it looks easy. I'm like, well, I could start three companies a year, right? But it's like, I wish I'd had it innately in me to be an entrepreneur or serial entrepreneur from my teens. I mean, I see a lot of those types of folks, particularly in crypto, and I'm so incredibly impressed by them. But that wasn't me.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like, whether or not it was innate, I guess you could argue, but it seems to have worked out once you did decide to sort of take the plunge. Obviously, you had success with the button or button, I think it was called. And then,
Yeah, and you know what? I'll just pause you there, only in the sense that, like, I even learned from that first experience. Like, Button, to your point, it's a great success, but it was not something I learned. I probably knew a year and a half in. It wasn't something I was crazy passionate about, but stuck it out for 4 years. And I think what I've learned from that experience, even the first entrepreneurial experience, and I've talked to other entrepreneurs on this, it's like, you have to focus on problems that get you really, really excited. Otherwise, it's really hard to go the long, long, long journey. Even with the block, so once the block started focusing on institutional information versus retail, I realized it wasn't the right company for me to run, and turned it over basically to the rest of the team, and they've just done an incredible job at taking it. So I think more entrepreneurs, certainly, I got better as I got honest with myself about what I was good at and what I really enjoyed doing. And LinksDAO is an expression of that. Like, I love community. There's a huge community aspect to it. I love golf, and I love the management team I work with. A number of them are folks who I've worked with before.
Yeah, I was going to say, it seems like you've landed in a good spot at the intersection of where your passions lie. So it took a couple of tries, but you finally got there. With the block, though, it's interesting because, like you mentioned, you started out sort of focused on educating retail. And then it sounded like sort of as a matter of circumstance with the bear market coming after the big, hype cycle in late 2017, early 2018, you had to focus on institutions because retail was sort of not as excited about it anymore for that time, for those few years. How did you sort of in spite of not having that like institutional passion, being more of a consumer guy, how'd you sort of, put your head down and still turn the block into what it is today, being one of the better resources out there?
If if I'm being candid, I was, and this often happens in entrepreneurship, I was very, very fortunate and lucky to have a wonderful team around me. Obviously, it was a team that I'd recruited in. So, I definitely get some credit for that. But what happened is the person who, the guy who's now the CEO, Mike McCaffrey, ended up being literally the perfect person to run an institutional information business. And so very, very fortunate that he was there at that time to sort of pick up the baton. I moved to the chairman role and he kind of moved forward without missing a beat, as opposed to us having to go out and find a CEO to run the business. And then, the team itself, because of the direction we got, and like they were actually very well attuned for an institutional research and media and news business. So it was really just, it was only like the founder was not a perfect fit for that market. And I guess in most cases that would be a death knell, but in our case, because we had a terrific, at the time he was the COO, alongside me, who ended up being the perfect CEO for that type of a business. It just worked out.
Yeah, I mean, to your point, the you could argue, the CEO's primary job is to recruit the right team, and it sounds like you did that very successfully with the Block. Any principles you can share on sort of your approach on recruiting and hiring execs, and also sort of as an asterisk on that, how does that change now that you're doing something very different, sort of not unprecedented, but there's not really a history of like recruiting for leadership for DAOs or anything like that. So I'm curious if there's any sort of things that you took from the old world that are maybe don't apply anymore, or things that you've switched on a little bit.
So good question. So the first thing is just like you have to be honest about what you're good at and what you're not good at. And so, my particular case, like really good at, vision setting and getting people really excited about an idea and publicly communicating and marketing. I think I'm good at your product and vision, but I'm not, for example, a COO, right? I'm not great at like operations. I'm not great at finance. Like I understand financial modeling and accounting. It's just not something I'm like passionate about. I'm good at sales, but I wouldn't say I'm good at sales operations. So the first thing is understanding what you're good at and what you're not good at. And then, recruiting folks in who have those skills. It's wild because like I'll look at a COO and be like, that person is magical. I have no idea how they do what they do. And then we'll have like a conversation like, I have no idea how you do what you do, dudis. And so that's usually a good thing if you feel like you have a top performer in these different roles and everybody appreciates what the other person or the other people are contributing. In terms of recruiting, what you'll find is also, don't be afraid to go after the person you don't think you can get. Those are the people who are, often like the biggest difference makers. And keep recruiting till you find like that absolute like 10x person. So have done that. In terms of your other question on, recruiting in for a like a Web3 network slash, air quotes DAO in terms of Links DAO, it's the thing that happens with these projects is that you are building in day one from day one in public. Okay. And so like the most important principle in my mind is if you have momentum and you attract people, you'll find like we had so many people contributing that it was almost easy. Like you could naturally see these like leaders emerge. And we just hired straight out of the community of folks who showed up. So, my advice to people who are looking for jobs in Web3 is show up. If you see a project you're excited about, just get in there and start contributing. So we, our head of community, is somebody who literally I'd set up a Discord for LinksDAO with Chris Mattern, one of my co-founders, and on day one, and I had no idea, how to moderate, and we were getting spam, and it was a mess. And this guy Cooper came in and turned it around like, instantaneously. I had to trust him. It was the person I just met because he gave him the keys of the Discord. There was nothing valuable. I mean, it was a day old, but could have gone to total crap. But he did a great job. And now he's a full-time member of the team and leads the community team. Same thing on the operations side. We had somebody who's been there from day one. So with these communities and these Web3 networks, hiring out of the community, I think, is something really, really powerful to do. And then once you've hired, the biggest thing is making sure that, you know, in our case, from a corporate perspective, that you're working deeply and closely with the community leaders. So we have not only a group of like full-time folks, but also a large group of contributors with, you know, a sizable you know, budget in terms of, you know, contributor earnings that they get for what they're building, as well as for special projects. And so, you know, basically you're not quote unquote hiring those folks, but you're nominating them and, you know, the community's voting on their ability to lead what we call pods in different functional areas. It's, you know, the key principle is just be very, very, in Web3, be very, very entrepreneurial in your hiring. And I think use your instincts and it's easier again for people to come in, demonstrate work. You know, they don't have to have like an internship, because you can start communicating and seeing their work from day one on a project.
Yeah, it's a great perspective. And I was just going to say, it's interesting. It's almost like you have 100 interns and you get to see how they work and then choose the cream of the crop versus having to hire out of an interview, which can be pretty challenging. There's some people who are just, you know, total studs and they just don't really interview well. Yeah. And then there's others who interview extremely well, but then you give them something to do and they sort of fall flat on the ground. So that's an interesting way of looking at it. Can you talk a little bit more about this pods concept that you just brought up? Because I was going to ask, you know, how you sort of how you take this energy and you sort of leverage it, you know, in the most sort of effective way possible. It sounds like you guys have come up with some sort of pod concept to take leaders from the community and give them responsibility and people to work with. Curious to hear how that sort of plays out.
Yeah. So in our case, largely there's a group of folks on the corporate team, one on the operations side and one on the community side, who generally liaise with the pods. Okay. And so they're really, really close. We have, weekly, but also weekly overall pod leaders meetings, but also, regular meetings of the specific pods themselves. What we did is we were very fortunate that our community leader Cooper designed a pod structure based on the needs of our specific DAO and, things like engineering, design, marketing, partnerships, finance and accounting, community moderation. So basically we have 12 pods or up to 12 pods authorized in all these different areas. And basically the pods themselves, it hasn't really been contentious, tend to nominate like the top contributor or contributors to be the leaders. And then they run with their agendas, and it's not like a permanent position. Like if you're not delivering, we've had some people move out of the pod leadership role. We've got people opt out of it as well and just say, hey, this is like too much for me. I have a full-time job. I can't be doing this in addition to that. So, you have to be a little more fluid and flexible. You have to recognize it's not somebody's full-time job. You're not relying on them like you would an employee. But it's so far for us been a really nice structure, to basically augment, what's happening at the corporate side.
Right. So, I know we're coming up on time. Last couple of questions here. You've been in Bitcoin since like 2013, I think you said, got full-time into crypto a few years later, sort of, had a company through the hype cycle and the crash. And now we had something maybe somewhat similar to that in 2020, 2021, big upswing, Bitcoin, but also Ethereum, all these altcoins. And now things have sort of settled down and settled down in terms of price and everything like that. What's your feeling about sort of where we are today and where we're going in terms of the market as a whole? Anything you've seen that's been sort of surprising since you first got involved? Bitcoin looked like it was maybe more about payments back then. That's how you discovered it, I think. And since then, it's sort of turned into more of this, digital gold thing. Ethereum's come about, all these other L1s, et cetera. Curious to hear just sort of your perspective on the landscape and where we are today.
Yeah. So, these are, as you mentioned, like emergent volatile markets and have been since I first purchased my first Bitcoin in 2013. And they had been before that, right? it's emergent money and emergent censorship resistant networks. And those are things that challenges governments, it challenges big corporations, it challenges vested interests. So you're going to have public pushback and criticism and regulation. But so I would say overall, there are definitely specific things that surprise me. Like, to your point, I would have thought Bitcoin maybe would have evolved and grown more quickly and maybe had more developers working on scaling solutions for cheaper payments, things like Lightning. It hasn't happened. And that activity and most of the best developers have moved on to other chains, places like Ethereum and Solana and Avalanche and Near and Terra. And so the and by the way, not only have moved, but the newest developers are coming in there because basically that's where applications can be built. So what I would say is it's remarkable how much positive stuff has been built in such a relatively short period of time, right? Since 2009. The explosion of interest in kind of like Web3 driven by NFTs, I would say that's surprised me, just how rapid and frankly sustained it's been so far. Sort of quick rise, quick fall in early 2021, then sort of rise back. And there have been different waves of things that have been popular from generative art was for a bit, now not so much. Axie for a bit, now not so much. But NBA Top Shot, which got me interested in NFTs for the first time, was popular for a bit, now not so much. But overall, the ecosystem continues to put forth products and applications that are capturing folks' imagination and time. Now, a lot of it is still, of course, speculation, both in terms of DeFi and in terms of NFT trading. I think we're finally starting to make it to the other side where people are building applications. I mentioned Stepin, but things that go beyond just pure speculation into tokens helping to orchestrate and bootstrap networks, things like Helium, right? Decentralized Wi-Fi hotspots, just things that I think will be mostly new technology. It like starts with fun and vice, and crypto's kind of been no different. And then it moves on and expands and grows into really, really interesting, powerful, world-changing areas. But honestly, play and fun are as important as anything.
Yeah, of course. And I think it's exciting despite the prices being down and things. It's hard to find any area that's got as many young smart people who are building so many different applications and just all over the spectrum. So excited to see where we are like 5 years from now.
Yeah, and
Last
price isn't.
question, go ahead.
Just price isn't that far. I mean, if we're being like price isn't that far down,
No,
right?
50%, something like that, maybe more for some,
Yeah, I mean,
not
it's
big players.
certainly up from where it was, in early 2021. And so, and then certain NFTs are, close to all-time highs. It just like depends on what assets you're in and what your point is.
I mean, if you're in Stepin, you're not doing so bad, I guess. But some of the others are taking a bit of a hit, and we'll see where everything lands when the dust
Fair.
settles.
Fair.
Last question, a little bit off track, but and I don't know how interested the audience will be here, but I'm interested. I was reading your blog and found that you're a Jets, Mets, and a Knicks fan. Not
Yeah.
too many people are have to endure that much suffering, but I'm one of them. It's a pretty good time though. The Jets had a good draft. The Mets have a hot start to the year. Thoughts on your favorite teams before we wrap up?
Yeah, so mine are Mets, Jets, Knicks, and then because they were so bad for so long in the early part of the last decade, I picked up Liverpool. So I'm living the dream. This is back when Liverpool hadn't won a Premier League title in 30 years, hadn't won Champions League in a long time. I guess they'd won one this century, and then they won their second while I was a fan. So that's been I was fortunate to pick up Liverpool as a team. I'm feeling good about the Jets draft finally. It's been an awful, awful 7, 8 years. Really embarrassing, candidly. It reminds me of when I became a Jets fan. My uncle brought me to games back when Freeman McNeil and Al Toon played in the 80s, and they were awful. Them and the Patriots were the worst. they've been like that for the last 8 years. I'm hopeful, you know, at some point in my lifetime, you know, we go on a run, you know, it'll be impossible to replicate what Brady did for the Patriots, but I'd love to see the Jets have a good run in them. And on better news, you know, the Mets are, you know, the dream, right? You have terrible owners in the Wilpons, and then, you know, Steve Cohen, who's got more money than just spending money on earth, comes along and is willing to spend it and actually spend it wisely with a good front office, it seems like this year. You know, we don't have our best pitcher, who's won what, the last two Cy Youngs, or two of the last three, I'm sorry. And he hasn't even played, and we have one of the best records in baseball. So it feels like it could be a special season for the Mets. But then again, they're the Mets. It always feels like it could be a special season. And, you know, then they're done by July. So hopefully we'll buck the trend this year. I'm also, you know, obviously a Stanford Cardinals sports fan. And unfortunately, it feels like our basketball and football glory days of early this century are sort of a fleeting past memory. We've been terrible for a while. So good news is I'm so busy with family and with crypto and with Web3 and with NFTs that I generally just have, you know, sports on in the background now versus like spending a night or going out with my buddies to watch games. So it actually works out that it's, you know, I'm not as, you know, rabid. I mean, I'm a deep fan, but not as rabid as I was a decade ago. But for example, you know, I'll do some work tonight and have the Rangers game on in the background. You know, obviously first time they've made the playoffs in a while. Had a really tough triple overtime game they lost the other night. I'm excited for them to hopefully win one tonight.
Yeah, it's nice. It's been, I've always joked being a fan of those teams, it builds character, I guess, is the one positive you could take from it. But, right. And the best time for the Jet to be a Jets fan has always been during the off season. So nothing different
during
this
the draft.
Year.
Nothing exactly. Different this year, right? At the best, exactly. The best draft.
Exactly. You know, this was a little bit abnormal, but you know, I'm sure they can still find a way to blow it. So we'll right. See. But
Zach Wilson will, I'm sure, blow it up, right?
Yeah, of course. The one guy we're counting on. But anyway, Mike, it's been a great time talking with you, and I appreciate you coming on the show. I know you got to run, but where can people go and follow you, you know, on Twitter, see what you're doing with LinksDAO, Six Man Ventures, everything like that?
Yeah. So just thank you, Jake, for having me on. Really appreciate it. Just go to anybody who's interested. Learn more at MDUDAS, at MDUDAS on Twitter. You know, my DMs are open. And so anybody who's interested in, you know, talking to me and or about any of those projects, VC and or LinksDAO, you know, DMs open, start there.